This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, it's great to have your company for The Country Hour today across South Australia and Broken Hill. I'm Cassie Huff. You might see the possibility of a chip shortage at your local fish and chip shop due to issues not just with sunflower oil but potato supply as well. There's some negotiations taking place at the moment with the Victorian and Tasmanian potato suppliers, but South Australian growers have come to an agreement with a processor, so I'll have more on what they've decided soon. Also, you might remember the Collinsville ram that recently sold. He weighed 178 kilograms. Big boy, and it's a big ask for a shearer to shear a sheep that big. So I'll tell you a bit more about a mobile shearing platform that allows shearers to shear without bending over using a semi-automated platform that lifts the ram up to waist height.
The shearing age group in Australia is getting older. Like, it's a tough job. These big guys take it out of you, and like I say, we're just trying to get in and do it a little bit easier on the sheep. And us.
More on that soon. But are sheep getting too big to find shearers to shear them? I'd really like to know what your experience is with this. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891, because it's a debate that's been playing out for a while now. It was recently reignited at the Australian Sheep and Wool Show, obviously with this ram weighing more than 170 kilograms. Rural reporter Angus Verley caught up with Trent Carter, the president of Manu Stud Merino Breeders Association, at the Victorian State Merino Field Day, and asked him his thoughts on this.
Oh, look, it certainly is a debate, and that debate will vary depending on who you're speaking to. Obviously, naturally, the general progression of the way you appeal and draw to a certain animal, bigger is always better, but how big is best, and that's probably the question we're talking about now. We do need to sit back and look at the broader industry as a whole. There's a lot of underlying issues that potentially may pop up, and the size of the animals that I suppose shearers, handlers, physical staff in yards, drenching, there is certainly some workplace issues that may come in play in future.
So in some cases at least, have rams got too big?
Yep, as I said, each very personal view. Yes, some rams are too big for sure. There are certain a lot of environments and breeding goals and directions around the country. Yes, big is best for sure up in the pastureless areas of Australia. In my personal view, yes, push down below into the high rainfall, higher stocking rate areas, and bigger certainly isn't best. It all gets back to, I suppose, returns per DSE. And in my personal experience, yes, the bigger sheep does fall away in those areas. The animal has to be built for purpose, and that purpose does vary a lot around Australia.
In terms of size, what is the breeding direction at your place?
We've introduced Australian breeding values for about 12 years now. So what we're doing is purely going through and measuring. We've got an accountable, written down stage as to where we're at now within our flock and within the industry. For us, yes, we are trying to certainly lower our mature ewe weight and also physical rams. That is through, shortening up the cannon bone, trying to get our sheep lower and shorter to the ground.
And why are you going down that path?
We've, as I said, been measuring for 10 to 12 years, and we find that those animals in tougher environments, just added constitution, do hold up in those tougher times.
Just returning to that general debate around ram size, whether they are too big and what that means, how much of a problem is it for those people who are running bigger animals to find people to shear them?
Look, shearing's only one issue, yes. It is getting a picky industry, really, now, I think. Every industry, everyone's struggling to find employees and staff. The world's their oyster when they're looking for a job. They can just say no and yes and pick and choose where they want to go. So the Australian, I suppose, agricultural industry, shearing industry, I think we really do need to stand back and evaluate things. Number one, I suppose, the shearing infrastructure, sheds. You know, gone are the days when we had shearing crews coming through and they'd live in the shearers' quarters, toilets, kitchens, amenities, all those things really need to look that hard. I think the agricultural shearing industry as a whole is well and truly behind. We look at other industries, 15 kilos, and I'd lift above without support. you know, a lot of females in the shearing industry now and doing such a phenomenal job from shed staff all the way through to shearing. So, you know, support them, back them, give females the clean entities that they deserve. So I think big is certainly going to be an issue and potentially is an issue. But, yeah, it's pulling it back to the reality, really, I think.
And so if there are more sheep to be shorn than there are shearers to shear them, and there are small animals and big animals, does that mean it will be get increasingly difficult to get shearers to shear those bigger animals?
Yes, certainly will be. I think big isn't always best. You've got to be fit for purpose. You don't need a 500 horsepower tractor to pull your 28 row combine. It certainly differs. And yeah, let alone the size of the animal, the amount of skin, how well they comb, how well they're covered on the points. Yes, there is a lot of issues that potentially will pop up.
People are doing lots of things already to try and make the shearing process easier. Lots of new infrastructure is going in, plenty in this part of the world, Western Victoria. Breeding direction is being considered in relation to shearing. So is enough happening now?
I think there is certainly things moving in. It is a very vast and diverse industry to change as a whole and all be 100% united in one view, which is difficult. You know, AWI are certainly working on a few innovative things now to certainly work with the catch and drag and trying to relieve that physical strain on shearers. And, you know, even just speaking to a couple of agricultural businesses in regards to sheep yards and shearing sheds, and they've got, you know, 120 jobs on their books just for people upgrading sheep yard shearing sheds, which is fantastic. You know, all shearing sheds going in are designed for a better fill, better catch, slope drags, things like that. And we're personally implementing things at home to certainly help. And it's number one, I think it's just about being proactive and on the front foot and working as an industry together. It might be only just a little 5%er, but as long as we're improving from year to year, we'll certainly hopefully be on the front foot for any challenges that come.
Trent Carter, the president of Manu Stud Merino Breeders Association, speaking with Angus Verley. What do you think about the size of rams and the effect it's having on shearing? Text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Obviously, it's getting a lot harder for people in the industry, but what if you could shear without bending over using a semi-automated platform to lift the ram up to about waist height? Larissa Smith caught up with shearers Jack Monks and Dave Axon to see a mobile trailer they've developed in action.
Load of rammer.
Yep.
You want to be our first patient, Larissa?
No. Hey.
Maiden voyage, Larissa, was finding out a lot of stuff.
And how's this one set up? How does this suit you?
Oh, yeah, it was easy enough to make it work. Just put a couple of panels in, make a small pen, a forcing yard, and, yeah, they normally follow. Once the first one goes up, they normally follow. They're quite happy to go uphill like that. Come on, big fella. Up you go. Up you go.
Rams are a fairly big unit to try and tackle. Not many shearers now are enthusiastic about it, so I just thought it's happening on the mainland. There's quite a few blokes on the mainland with these mobile trailers with the machines on them, upright shearing machines, and Jack happened to be doing a job for a farmer down the Midlands on one such machine that was the first one in Tassie, and I said, well, let's have a go and see if you want to be part of it, we'll set one up and see how it goes.
What did you start with?
The machine. Ordered it from Peak Hill over in New South Wales, and then a local trailer maker in Deloraine came to our rescue and sort of designed the trailer with the help of Jack and I, and first trial run today.
Jack, how does it work?
This way we don't have to sedate them and they can come straight out of the paddock, straight onto the trailer and straight back to the paddock.
Yeah, so they up the race here, they get clamped and spun onto a flat shearing platform which sort of rotates once they're clamped in place, and the other one will come up beside it and you can clamp him ready for the next lot. It takes the catch and drag out of it. That's where a lot of the injuries happen with shearers, is trying to catch these big guys in the pen and drag them out. It usually takes two or three blokes to tip them. Well, these big sheep anyway.
How much do these weigh today, these practice ones?
This mob's not so bad. They'd be around the 80 kilo mark, but just looking over the fence, there's three big bruisers out the back there. They'll be pushing 120.
And what can they get up to?
Dorsets, 150, 160 kilos, and no one wants to tackle them.
Shearers are still having to do it.
Oh, that's right, they are. They probably don't enjoy it, but That's the way it is. And we're just trying to take a bit of that out of it.
Preserve your back.
Yeah, longevity.
Are they at your waist height? How high do they come up?
We've got the machine set up now just so it's, yeah, just level with our waist. And everything's done, as the name states, in a long blow pretty much. You start with clearing the crutch out, maybe the neck, and then just rotate it, doing long blows.
You've been working together, but this is set up so that you could work on your own doing this?
Yeah, it's a one-man operation, Larissa. It depends on the situation, the amount of stock. It's one person can do it quite comfortably. If they have someone to assist them pushing them up, yeah, it's no trouble in keeping the wool away.
How many would you get through in an hour? What are you aspiring to?
Well, we're hoping that two of us can comfortably shear 100 big rams a day and probably do 140 big crossbred ewes or something, but 150 maybe, but yeah, comfortably. But one man should do 80 to 100 a day.
So a little bit slower than shearing in a conventional shed?
Yeah, a bit slower, but it's all about just getting the sheep in the machine and getting them set up. So it takes us a little while to back in and get set up. We'll get better as we go, but yeah, it's just practice.
Would you say that there's a gap in the market that you're looking to fill?
I wouldn't say we're trying to fill a gap, but there's definitely a gap there, and we just want to get our foot in the door and see how it goes. Like I say, the shearing age group in Australia is getting older. Like it's a tough job. These big guys take it out of you, and like I say, we're just trying to get in and do it a little bit easier on the sheep and us.
If we can go down the Derwent Valley for like 4 or 5 weeks, then come back to the Midlands or go up to the northeast, and that's going to be the hard part, to try and coordinate everyone. But I'm sure everyone's going to help, because a lot of these flock rams are worth $2,000 a head, and if you've got to look after them, and it's all about animal husbandry and good work practices.
And they seem to be reasonably calm. I'm quite surprised at how calm they are in that race.
They're secure. They're secured in some leg fasteners, and once they're on there, they generally behave themselves. It's easy as that.
Come on. You got him.
Shearers Dave Atchin and Jack Monk speaking with Larissa Smith about their new mobile shearing trailer. They're trialling it on some Borderlester rams at a property in northern Tasmania, but it'd be good to see that in action. And I've had a text in from Neville from Jamestown, who believes they are getting way too big and buying smaller plan rams with high fertility and more DSE per hectare. That's what he's doing. His son's a shearer of 65 kilos, and some of the rams are more than double his height and sit taller than he stands. That is, I can actually imagine that would be the case. These rams are getting massive. Thanks so much for your text. Like I said, you can continue the conversation. Text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. It's coming up to 18 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, we'll turn to grapes now, because for grape growers, weighing a bunch of grapes only really gets done a few times a year, but some new technology is going to see bunch weight being able to be recorded all year round and even at multiple times during the day as well. With some funding received from the state government's AgTech Growth Fund, viticulturist Amanda Marta from the Barossa Valley has come up with a real-time bunch weight measurement device that can be used out in the vineyard. And she explains to Brooke Nindorf how it could work and the benefits it would bring to the industry.
This is real-time bunch weight measurement device that measures bunch weight expressed in grams every hour of the day, from when the grapes begin to ripen right through to harvest.
So it's a continuous weighing of the grapes that are on there?
That's right, yeah. So every hour it will provide a reading expressed in grams.
And so this is something that hasn't been seen before?
To my knowledge, it's the first of its kind.
And so how will it actually work?
I can't disclose too much information for IP reasons, but it's based on load cell technology coupled with a continuous data logger that's linked to the cloud. And then what it does, it brings out an Excel format of bunch weight, and then we graph it and analyse the data.
And so how does the load cell system work without having to go into too much detail?
Pretty much, if you can imagine, like when you're weighing a fish, when you have that awesome big catch, when you hook the fish onto a fish hook, basically you pull on it and then you can detect the weight of the fish. So that's pretty much the same analogy of what we're doing here.
And so what will it mean for grape growers to have this kind of technology available?
Oh, look, yeah, I think it's going to be a great tool for wine grape growers. It will help wine grape growers to manage their precious water resources more efficiently, because we'll begin to understand the dynamics on how bunch weight responds to rainfall events and irrigation application. So there is potential, yeah, to assist vineyard managers and viticulturalists to refine the irrigation practice by looking at the data and what the bunch weight's doing. Also, it will help us to significantly improve our yield forecasting reliability. Currently, we have an error of plus or minus 30%, so it's something we need to work on as a whole industry. And also, you can use this technology to select an optimal harvest date to improve wine grape quality. So there's a few things that we could see benefits.
And I guess you can keep an eye on different patterns throughout the year as well.
Oh, most definitely. Absolutely, yeah. Love the data. Just gives us an insight. It's something we've never seen before, you know, how bunch weight responds to, say, a heat wave, to a cool spell, to an irrigation application, and, yeah, also, yeah, how much does the bunch weight increase after, say, a 10 mil rainfall event. So this is data that we've never seen before.
How much would the bunch weight change to when it's been picked, the weight when it's been picked?
Yeah, so it can change. Say if you have a heat wave prior to harvest, you know, sometimes you could see, you know, up to maybe a 20 gram reduction in bunch weight. And then some days where the temperatures are sort of quite low, or around, say, the 25 degree mark, we can see bunch weight starts to increase again after a heat wave. And also we can see bunch weight increases quite markedly after a rainfall event. And sometimes we see that once the berries have hit that shrivel point, even if you apply an irrigation, there's absolutely no response in bunch weight to irrigation, meaning we could potentially cut out an irrigation or two per season once the berries have reached their shrivel point. So, yeah, quite exciting data.
Viticulturist Amanda Marder speaking with Brooke Neindorf. We're going to get to the weather soon because there's a pretty interesting front moving across the state, but it's making pretty clear that there are still a few more weeks of winter. It's still been quite cool lately. If you're thinking, though, that there might be some warmth coming, you're not alone. It's a worrying time for Riverland growers as higher temperatures can see fruit flies start mating in greater numbers. So what can you do to reduce the risk of fruit flies breeding in your own backyard? Well, entomologist expert Andrew Jessop explains to Eliza Burlage about heat mapping fruit fly hotspots in gardens.
Knowing your enemy, if you like, it's a good thing with Queensland fruit fly, because right at the moment you're probably not seeing much action of fruit fly because it's just too cold for them to be out there and doing something. But as the days warm up, in particularly the evenings, they start to move around a bit more, and as soon as they can find some protein to feed on, then they start mating again and start laying eggs again. So now is a crucial time to start looking for evidence of fruit fly.
And you were mentioning in your talk that fruit fly really have quite an exciting life, especially at this time of year. The males and the females are looking for food and possibly looking to mate as we slowly start to get some evenings around, was it 16 to 17 degrees as a danger time?
Yes, when the sunset is around 15 to 16 degrees, that is the time of day when they mate and the temperature at which they mate. So anything cooler than that, they just won't mate. And this is starting to happen now towards the end of August and certainly into September. Those evenings will reach the temperature where flies, if they can find each other, will mate and lay eggs within a day or two after that.
When people think about fruit fly and what a big problem it is, you really demonstrated just how prolific breeders they are. I mean, breed like rabbits, they almost should say breed like fruit flies.
Yes, they do say that flies can multiply very quickly. So even if you had one female and she mates just the once, we've done some tests on them and they can lay over 2,000 eggs within her lifetime. And out of those 2,000 eggs, another 800 adult flies come out of it. So when you look at it, one fly can produce 800 new adults within a very short time. So you can see how the population can explode quite quickly if you don't look after them.
And in attendance today, we've had a lot of growers. There's a spraying demonstration going on right now that we can hear in the background. But I thought what was really great is in your presentation, just talking about some of the actions that growers and community local gardeners can do to be aware of some of those literal hotspots in their garden.
Yes, literal hotspots, exactly the right word, because even in a normal backyard, you'll find some warm spots or spots that are slightly warmer than the rest of the garden or, in fact, the orchard over the fence. And it's quite likely that flies, as winter approaches, find those warm spots and overwinter there as adults. And we've found that particularly lemon trees and other heavy canopied evergreen trees that are close to the house that are heated in the wintertime, they're an ideal spot for adults to stay over winter. And then as spring warms up, they move out of those spots and then into your garden or orchard after that. So looking for flies in those areas, particularly if there's fruit on the tree, putting a trap or a bait there is quite a good idea.
Was it you that mentioned they can even be found in rosehip?
Yes, it's been sort of known for many years that rosehips might be a host to fruit fly, but a recent paper from Queensland has shown quite convincingly that one rosehip can produce somewhere around 2 to 3, up to 5 new fruit fly, just the one rosehip. So it's now been classified as a moderate host.
I did not know that about rosehip. That was Andrew Jessop from Janrin Consulting speaking with Eliza Burlarge. We'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, where senior forecaster Mark Analak has the latest. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie.
Sounds like there's rain on the way and possibly hail as well.
Oh, just a little bit, but just enough to tempt you, really. Look, just looking back at the last 24 hours, we did have a band of cloud moving across the southern half of the state. Rainfall totals with that band have been quite light, to be honest, of the order of 1 to 5 millimetres through much of the agricultural area. There were some parts, Western Kangaroo Island and Lower Eyre Peninsula, saw a little bit more. We've had reports of the order of 10 to 20 millimetres through those two districts. But now that band has moved up to sort of the northern agricultural areas, southern parts of the pastoral district, streaming down from sort of Woomera through southern parts of the Flinders, northern parts of the Mid-North and into the Riverland. There's not much in it, to be honest. There might be the odd spotty stuff here and there, but falls are very light and the system is weakening. That moves us on to a cold front that's passing just onto the southern coast or just to the coastline of South Australia at the moment. That's bringing in some further showers and a southwesterly wind change. So we'll see those showers push across agricultural areas overnight, or this afternoon and overnight tonight. So we're expecting the showers to push as far north as the northern agricultural area. But obviously, the closer you are to the coast, the more frequent the showers will be. And those showers will continue through Friday and in a southwesterly airstream. A second front will pass over overnight Friday night into Saturday, and as a result, a slight increase in shower activity for agricultural areas in the early hours of Saturday morning. And then it all starts to settle down for a few days. A high pressure system moves in from the west. Conditions start to settle for the latter part of Saturday and Sunday. We may even start to see some early morning frost and fog patches, particularly inland on Sunday, probably Monday as well, before another cold front comes through on Monday, which will see a re-intensification of shower activity across agricultural areas. In terms of rainfall amounts, I guess, look, for the most part, we're talking about to the end of Monday, falls of 5 to 20 millimetres, mostly occurring in the next sort of 24 to 40 hours, and then again on Monday. So 5 to 20 about the agricultural areas, 20 to 40 about southern coasts and the Mount Lofty ranges. Anything further north than that, we're probably looking at single figure rainfall areas for the northern agricultural areas and southern parts of the pastoral districts. Nothing much beyond north of about Lee Creek. And as I mentioned, some showers early part of next week. That'll continue into the middle part of next week with showers persisting over agricultural areas. There was a little suggestion of some hail. Yes, we could see some hail overnight tonight, but mostly about the southeast corner. There might be some small hail with any showers that occur overnight tonight. But I'll be watching the system next Tuesday because that's when it looks like we'll see the coldest air move over. So in short, Cassie, we'll look for that stuff next Tuesday to give us some good hail.
Hopefully it's some good soaking rain, though, for people who need it in the meantime. Thanks for that, Mark Analak, from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the Upper Western's going to be mostly sunny, medium chance of showers in the south in the early morning, near zero chance elsewhere. It's going to get down to 6 to 10 degrees during the day, but during the day it's going to get to 17 to 20 degrees. The Lower Western will be partly cloudy and there is a high chance of showers in the east. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 5 and 8, with daytime temperatures reaching around 17 degrees. It's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, I'm so glad you could join me. It's great to have your company across South Australia, Broken Hill and Adelaide. And you might have seen there's a possibility of a chip shortage at your local fish and chip shops due to issues with not just sunflower oil, but potatoes as well. Now, South Australian growers have come to an agreement with a processor, while the Tasmanian and Victorian farmers are yet to do so. So I'll have more on what's been decided soon. And also, apples grown in the Adelaide Hills. It's a significant industry for that part of the world, and we're going to hear from a grower there who has spent the best part of his life in the South Australian apple industry, I should say, and he looks back on his career and some of the big changes that have taken place. But first we have to find out what's making news with Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, the Nationals are raising concerns about former Prime Minister Scott Morrison's secret powers, saying there are more questions to be answered. Mr. Morrison secretly took on 5 extra portfolios while he was leader and did not tell most cabinet ministers. He used the powers to override the Resources Minister, the Nationals MP Keith Pitt, and block a gas project off the coast of New South Wales. The Deputy Premier Susan Close believes any health workers' rights to free car parking need to be part of enterprise bargaining negotiations. The former state government brought in free parking during the COVID pandemic, but the deal has now ended. Many health workers will rally in the city tomorrow over the issue. The state's unemployment rate fell again during July to 4%. That's down 0.3 of a percentage point on June, but it remains the highest rate in Australia. The national jobless rate also fell slightly to 3.4%. And in cricket, the Adelaide Strikers have re-signed Test batsman Travis Head for another 2 seasons. He took over as captain of Adelaide in 2017 and steered the franchise to its first BBL title win. That's the latest ABC News.
Thanks for that, Matt. Now, Southeast potato growers have successfully renegotiated a contract with a major processor. It's a first for the region, and what it's going to see is growers are going to have a levy added into the contract with McCain Foods to reflect the rising input costs of fuel and fertiliser. It comes as Victorian and Tasmanian growers demand significant price rises for their produce. Negotiating Committee Chair Tim Heisen explains to Megan Hughes how this levy is going to work.
We've completed our negotiations. At this point, we still need to have a look at the final contract, but other than that, we've completed it.
Are you happy with how they've gone?
Yes, I mean, growers are never happy when they've negotiated outcomes of contracts. I think the outcome's been one that both parties are reasonably content with.
Does it reflect the increase to import costs?
Yes, it does. So there's been quite a lot of work put in by the growers and also McCain to devise a levy system which covers the inputs of fertiliser and fuel, which have been extremely volatile in the last 6 months or so.
This levy system, is this something that came out of these recent lot of negotiations, or was this something already in place?
No, this is something quite new. It's really been the only way to address the volatility that we're seeing. You know, we've seen fertiliser prices triple. Well, we all know what fuel's been doing. Fortunately, it's coming back a little bit, but nevertheless, you know, there's a lot of volatility out there. And when you're growing on a contract basis, you're not getting the benefit of the higher prices that some other commodities are getting. This is really the only way of dealing with it. Obviously, our customer, and in this case, McCain, will have to pass some of this on to their customers.
So could you explain to me how this levy is going to work?
Reasonably complex because there's a couple of levels of it. There's one on fertiliser and one on fuel and one on freight. Freight is purely fuel-based, but freight depends on distance as to how that works. But basically, it relates to increases in costs from the previous season, not the season that's just gone, but the season prior to that, when we had stability of fuel and fertiliser. So we're talking costs that were incurred for our crop in 2020, so that any costs that have increased from that point to now are taken of through the levy. And then the other part of the negotiations were concerning the base price. So the base price is there permanently, and that covers other increases that are happening all the time. And we're seeing plenty of those, obviously, with various costs in terms of machinery and labour and what have you.
Where did the idea come from?
I think mainly because we've seen this happen once before. It was a spike in costs that occurred some years ago. I can't exactly recall the dates now, but it was probably about 15 or 16 years ago, and it was particularly with fertiliser where we saw a huge spike in fertiliser prices. And it really came about, I think, because of the mandated ethanol requirement in the United States, and it sucked a lot of fertiliser out of the system to try and produce ethanol, basically. And there were shortages, and up went the price of fertiliser, and we then had to negotiate to cover that. And it didn't last very long, and it hurt the industry because there wasn't a mechanism to react to it when it came back down again. And that's what we're hoping will happen here, that, you know, if our costs go up, they're covered. If they go down, well, income we won't receive, but that similarly, we won't be paying the costs.
So this levy is now going to be in any future contracts that the Southeast growers will negotiate with McCain?
That really hasn't been determined. At this stage, it's just in this year's contract. And as to whether it's in future contracts is yet to be decided. We'd like to think that this time next year we will have returned to much more normal trading conditions. I think that's unlikely, but if that was the case, then there probably wouldn't be a need for the levy.
And how much of a difference do you think this levy will make to growers in the southeast?
What it's doing is just compensating them for the volatility in the cost increases. So obviously it'll give growers security that in these uncertain times, that should there be further volatility, they're going to be covered. We hope that's not the case, because it's not good for anyone. I have a feeling that we're probably at the top of the volatility curve, but as I said earlier, we're in uncertain times, and we've got to be prepared for that.
McCain Negotiating Committee Chair Tim Heisen speaking with Megan Hughes. And in a statement, a McCain Foods spokesperson said that they're in constant dialogue with growers throughout the course of the year and are currently in ongoing discussions with their Victorian and Tasmanian growers. We're going to stay with fruit and vegetables, because I don't know if you ever sit back and think about how far Australia's come in agriculture. No matter whether you've been farming 10 years or 40 or multi-generational, there have been a lot of changes in the industry. And Robert Green is a former Farmer of the Year and has been a part of the apple industry in South Australia's Adelaide Hills for his entire life. And he took Luke Radford on a trip back through his career.
I left school, came home and worked with my father and grandfather, and I guess did my apprenticeship, and then started to sort of question the way that they were going about things that to some degree hadn't changed for 60 or 70 years.
Now that's a big point, because when we have that kind of changeover of generations, it can get quite, tetchy between sort of those that come before and the new upcoming ones with the new ideas. How did that transition go for you?
I think it would be fair to say that I learnt the skill of debating, and I guess I had to be able to put up a convincing argument, and in the end I think my father's probably got sick of me badgering him, and he offered me the back paddock and said, you can get up there and try this newfangled stuff if you want to.
Well, speaking of newfangled, in the time you've had it, you nearly tripled the amount of trees per hectare to start off with, then you did it again a few years ago as well, including all kinds of new management techniques, as you were mentioning, with trellises and the like. What was that whole journey like?
I think at the time it was just a case of you were doing what you felt was right, and you, I guess we had some inspirations along the way and experiences. I was very, very fortunate to be able to travel both nationally, but then in a few latter years internationally, and especially when you venture into places into Europe, their society and industry seem to be 10 or 15 years a bit further advanced than us. Land and resource constraints and labour, the cost of labour, those sort of things influenced them before us, so it was a good place to go and see how they adapted to change.
So you think we're playing catch-up then?
We just progressed slower than what their society did, and I don't know that we're necessarily playing catch-up. I think that there's plenty of examples of apple growers in this country that are at or above what you might consider world best practice in terms of production per hectare and overall efficiency. You know, there's some very, very good operators.
Speaking of operations, one of the big challenges you face back in Lenswood in the Adelaide Hills is, of course, the availability of water in that section of the world can be quite tricky at times, especially during summer, which does get quite dry. Now, you had to kind of almost self-develop the technique you've been using, really. And what was that like?
Yeah, well, it was one of trial and, I guess, explore and try to get a bit of advice from particularly people from this region, where I think they had a better sense of water use efficiency perhaps before we did. But I think trial and error, once again, it depends a little bit on the personality that you are, and if you're into wanting to research and sort of investigate things, I think that's probably just the sort of person I was. And I explored some of these concepts, and you put in a little bit of a trial, and it might only just be a small scale block, 1 year, 2 years, you play around and you assess, you know, what you're achieving from it. So it was research and development at home level, yeah.
You were giving a presentation earlier and you mentioned that there are quite a few challenges in front of apple growers right across the country in Australia. In your mind, what are the biggest ones that we're facing in the next 10 to 20 years?
10 to 20 is probably a bit too far out. My crystal ball's not that good. I probably think that things change so quickly and it's very difficult to preempt what might be around the corner and about to duck out from left field. But we can certainly see that right at the moment there's been a volume of trees planted and that are still to come into production that is going to lead to supply point pressures in terms of marketing the crop that is going to be grown in the next, you know, 1 to 5 years short term. So I think we suffer from this declining domestic consumption. There's a lot more choices out there these days. We, for a long time, obviously have been offering apples 52 weeks of the year, but, you know, bananas and berries in particular, that berry category has really grown, and seldom do you have a bad experience with berries. So their focus has been on quality and that being able to do that intensively and from a managed crop point of view. So we've got competitors from other categories, and imports, you know, seasonality has changed a lot for the likes of, you know, citrus and stone fruit and cherries, and a lot of this stuff, you know, from time to time bobs up from international suppliers. So seasonality is affecting sales opportunity for our category.
One of the other big challenges facing the industry as a whole is this sort of, I guess, new reliance on club varieties, and there's a stack of them about to come into the marketplace. So looking ahead at that, I mean, you said there's like 30 something potentially on the horizon. How on earth do you navigate that?
To answer that question, I suppose, put yourself in consumer's situation. Personally, I think I'd be looking for something that is a unique offering, something that stands out, has a point of difference. You know, is it the way it looks? Is it the way it tastes? Is it, you know, the size of it? Whatever, you know, you really need to stand out from the crowd now, and you have to offer something that is memorable for consumers and value for money.
Robert Green from Lenswood in South Australia's Adelaide Hills speaking there with Luke Radford. And it is coming up to 18 minutes to one.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Another bid to gather more information and control the numbers of kangaroos across the state. The Kangaroo Partnership Program grant has just been developed. Now, this project is going to allow organisations to apply for up to $15,000 in funding. And the SA Arid Lands Landscape Board is looking for involvement from sectors such as farming, conservation and landscape management, as well as animal welfare to be involved. General Manager of the SA Arid Lands Landscape Board, Jody Gregg-Smith, spoke with Dylan Smith about the project and why the board is looking to take a proactive approach to controlling the numbers of the animal.
People would be aware that in recent years we've had big numbers of kangaroos right across South Australia, and part of the Landscape Act lends itself to working more closely with community and partners to overcome or support outcomes associated with overabundance of native species where they're causing a significant impact. The South Australian Landscape Priorities Fund was an opportunity to get some resourcing and develop a project which is called the Kangaroo Partnership Project, where we're seeking to work alongside of the Department for Environment and Water, the harvesting industry, the conservation sector, the animal welfare groups and landholders themselves, collectively find solutions to managing the devastating impact that too many kangaroos have on the environment, the animal welfare issues of them dying of starvation in really serious drought conditions, and also, of course, just the amenity to road users and communities where there are so many numbers of kangaroos.
What are some of these impacts that these kangaroos have on the environment?
The numbers have been so huge in recent years that they have overgrazed some of our most vital production and agricultural country, but also some of our highest value conservation areas in South Australia. What that does is it hastens the onset of drought because there's no ground cover to sort of help manage healthy, balanced ecosystems. And what it means is that the production and agriculture sectors have nothing to feed their stock. A lot of landholders over recent years destocked so that they were allowing for pastures to regenerate, particularly in the pastoral country in the outback and the rangelands areas of the state. And no sooner had they taken their sheep and cattle off of properties were they absolutely overrun with tens of thousands of kangaroos who were just desperate to find something to eat because of the drought conditions right across the state. So that's one very significant impact. I guess the other really important thing to note is we've created some of these problems because we've got water point to water stock. So they will come in to where we've created that opportunity when the natural water systems have dried up in drought conditions. And when we have mass convergences of these sorts of numbers into our areas, there's not enough to sustain them. They just die a terrible, terrible, slow, cruel death, which is quite preventable if we look at alternative ways to manage such big numbers and get ahead of that problem ever becoming at that scale again.
And I understand a grant funding program is now open to organisations. You know, what does this involve and who is eligible?
About $90,000 in grant money start to consider ideas for overcoming the issues. And we will encourage landholders, field processors, meat processors, the conservation sector and land managers to work together rather than in isolation. We would love to see some First Nations groups being involved in this because we also recognise the cultural values of kangaroos, both totemic species in their cultural history, but also as a food source that's been food source long before we started commercialising it and turning it into a really marketable product globally. We would love all of those partners to consider how they can better work together and submit applications, whether that is to do trials on sites, whether that's about creating certain fencing systems to protect certain high conservation value properties that have been negatively impacted, whether that's about working at different ways to change the attitudes about kangaroo meat as a commodity that is very healthy, very lean, ethically sourced and humanely sourced. There are a number of different things that we would love people to get their thinking caps on to apply for up to $15,000 per grant to try some of these things and test what's possible to help manage the issue that has become so large.
Have you already been working with, you know, some organisations in the regions about ideas on how to get the numbers down, or it's really preliminary at this stage?
There've been lots of discussions over lots of years about the issue and how to overcome it, and we're really mindful that some of the solutions are challenging because there's an absence of social licence or people accepting that the most humane way to deal with animals in certain instances is to humanely destroy them or harvest them for other uses and products. And because community and industry, the agriculture sector have been so negatively impacted by these big numbers of kangaroos, we thought it was appropriate that they become very much an active part of the solution and find easier ways for them to navigate how to do that through stronger links between all of the players, which is what we hope the partnership will result in.
General Manager for the SA Arid Lands Landscape Board, Jodie Gregg-Smith, speaking with Dylan Smith. Now, it's a pretty common phrase we hear at the moment when it comes to climate change, and that is net zero. What if I told you there's actually a new goal that people are aiming for? Lucy Cooper sat down with Professor Mark Howden, the director of the ANU Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions, and also the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as well as Dr. Annika Molesworth, a farmer, scientist and author. And Professor Howden told her that net zero is just the beginning.
The science is really clear, is that if we want to keep temperatures below 2 degrees, and if possible down to 1.5 degrees, we not only have to go to net zero, but we have to go below zero. So net zero is actually a waypoint, it's not an end point in our emission reduction journey. And that's a really big challenge because it's going to be hard enough to get to net zero, but getting below zero requires a completely different rethink. So when we talk about going below zero, that particularly relates to carbon dioxide, which we have to reduce that below zero because carbon dioxide accumulates in the atmosphere, where it's a bit different from methane and nitrous oxide, where we can actually reduce by less than 100%. So, for example, a scenario that's consistent with 1.5 or 2 degrees means about 60% reduction in methane and around about 30% reduction in nitrous oxide. So whilst it's still significant reductions, it's actually much more achievable than fully cancelling those out.
In terms of Farmers for Climate Action, are you guys asking for net zero, or are you going that extra step and trying to get below zero?
So Farmers for Climate Action, we are very much evidence-based, and so we listen to what the experts are telling us where we need to be to, you know, make sure that we actually have a productive and profitable farming system long into the future. Me personally, where we are now, it's not good enough. Like, we are already seeing mass bleaches in the coral reef. We're seeing, you know, mass die-offs in the Murray-Darling Basin and the Barker-Darling River of fish species. So the state of the environment and the climate at the moment is in a really bad state. If we say we're going to let it get to, you know, 1.52 degrees above, we're looking at a world that, you know, I think would be inexcusable to let happen.
There's always that kind of pressure that this change needs to come only from farmers. They sometimes feel that the onus is just on them. So how does agriculture balance the need for increased production, you know, to feed a growing population with the need to care for the environment and reach these goals?
So we have a rapidly growing global population, so we need to be feeding everyone, but feeding them well, like nutritional diets that are actually good for bodies. Here in Australia, I think we throw out like 1 in 4 supermarket bags of food. You know, the food waste is terrible. And if we even just like address this problem, that would go a long way in actually making sure that we are looking after the environment in those farming systems, because that water didn't need to be extracted from that river if we're just chucking it in the bin. You know, those fertilizers didn't need to be applied, that those trees didn't need to be removed. So if we can address the food waste problem, which accounts for something like 30% of emissions in the food and farming system, I think that will go a long way in actually helping us address the greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, and as well as reducing food loss and waste, which is really crucial, we also need to look at efficiencies, so how we can become more efficient in our use of farmland and farming inputs in terms of what we produce. There's also some really significant benefits to be made by changing dietary composition, so moving away from high emissions diets towards low emissions diets, which tend to be actually much healthier diets and often much cheaper diets at the same time.
Everyone's discussing the cost of living, and a part of that is the rising price of food that they've noticed in the supermarkets. Does climate change have a role in that rising cost at all?
I think there's a good case to be made that we don't pay enough for food because we don't actually pay for the externalities, the off-site negatives of food production, say from greenhouse gas emissions or pollution of our waterways and things like that. So we need to, I think, have a realistic discussion about what is appropriate prices to pay for food, what's a fair price to pay for food. And in the process, I think we'll start to value food more and we'll waste food less simply because of that. We'll also, I think, increase the status of farmers in the community. So rather than being seen as sort of industrial tractor drivers, they'll actually be seen for the very skillful decision makers that they are. And so I think if we had that discussion, there'd be potentially quite a lot of benefits which would actually bring both environmental, financial and social components which make all of Australia's better off change.
Professor Mark Howden and Dr. Annika Molesworth speaking with Lucy Cooper. Finally today, life in rural areas presents a range of challenges, and it can be hard to put your hand up when you're struggling, but York Peninsula's Rural Health Initiative, Fat Farmers, is on a mission to change that. The group of farmers banded together after identifying the need to improve their mental and physical health, and this week they've organised the Unbreakable Farmer, Warren Davis, to tour the Eyre Peninsula and share his story about surviving the millennium drought. Tessa Colliver, who is the Executive Officer of Fat Farmers, helped bring the tour to light and speaks about the positive impact Fat Farmers has had on their community.
Fat Farmers started back in 2010 with three farmers started going to a gym at Maitland on Central York Peninsula, and they found it to be so beneficial that they wanted to get other guys involved. We now also have groups dotted around South Australia, and we're keen to expand our groups here on Eyre Peninsula. So we thought we would get a guest speaker involved.
What specific benefits have you seen from having the Fat Farmers initiative in your community?
The physical benefits of regular exercise, but also very much, I know the guys have noticed the mental health benefits, things like better sleep, better mood, can help reduce stress and manage those kind of things. And also the fact that it's group exercise means that you get that social connection. And I know certainly with all our groups, people like going along to have a bit of a chat and a laugh with everyone else.
And as you mentioned, you have brought in a special speaker. Why is it important for the community to hear from different people who have overcome some challenges in their life?
We asked Warren Davies to be part of our EP tour because he does also have a farming background, and we felt that was a good match with farmers. But also now, having heard Warren tell his story last night, he really does take you on a bit of a journey of what he's been through, but also on a more positive note, give some steps on how you can help yourself and also others.
After losing his dairy farm during the millennium drought, Warren Davies set on a search to find his purpose and identity. Part of that search was doing a speaker course where he learnt a lot about himself, the value of his story, and why it was so important to share it.
The more that I shared my story, the more that I probably shared a little bit more about my mental health journey. And yeah, from there, I started realising from the feedback that I was getting that I was having an impact on the people that were coming along and empowering those people then to share their own story.
I assume after suffering such a huge personal loss, such as losing your property, you speaking about it would and still is probably a really cathartic process for you.
That's a very, very perfect summation of how I feel. It is really a cathartic experience. Sharing my story to others and helps me just as much as hopefully it helps the people that come along and hear me talk. Some engagements are tougher than others. It just depends where I am emotionally and how my mental health is at that time. Because part of this process is that my challenge with my mental health and my mental illness will always be an ongoing thing. It's just having the strategies in place to be able to deal with that. But yeah, I find it very cathartic.
It's a really brave thing that you do, and probably you could say it's a lot easier to not speak about it and just to battle on. But how important would you say it is to talk about this and be vulnerable and share these stories with others?
That's really the whole instigating comment that a facilitator of the speaker program that I did made to me, said, "You've got a story and who are you not to share it?" And as I've obviously gone along as a speaker, I think it's conversations around mental health or any challenges that we're facing in a community is really important. And that's part of my mission. So my mission is around creating awareness and education around mental health and well-being, but it's also about inspiring conversations and then empowering people to seek help. And one of the most important thing about sharing those conversations or your own story, that power of storytelling, is, you know, whether it's a neighbor or a family member or the person, you know, that you bump into down the street, that piece of wisdom that you might share with them can help them along their journey. Always look at it as if there's one person in the room that resonates with my story and uses that to either help themselves or help, you know, someone that they love move through their journey, well, then I'm a happy man.
The Unbreakable Farmer, Warren Davis. And if you or anyone know someone who needs support, you can contact organisations like Beyond Blue on 1300 22 1300 224636. That's 1300 224636. And a few texts have come in. John has texted in to say it's hard enough to get people to think about net zero carbon, but minus net zero, that would make people's heads explode. Whereas Rick from Hove says it's unachievable, and that there is information out there that people can watch to get their take on that. A few texts have come in. Sonia Feldhoff, though, is coming up on your radio next for Adelaide listeners.
Hi, Cassie. Now, I tell you what, we've got some rain, more rain expected, and quite a lot coming.
I've been watching the radar.
I don't know about you, but I've got every now and again buckets hanging around getting the drips in from the roof in my house. But apparently there are plenty of buckets around the Adelaide Railway Station as well. What's going on there? Do we have a leak there? We're going to get some answers, hopefully, after one.
Thanks for that. Sonny Feldhoff on your radio, as well as The World Today for regional listeners. It's coming up to 1 o'clock, time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.